Welcome to Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Takeda, we had the pleasure of speaking with John V. Haymock, MD, PhD, Chair, Professor, and David Bruton Jr. Chair in Cancer Research in the Department of Thoracic, Head and Neck Medical Oncology, and Professor in the Department of Cancer Biology, Division of Cancer Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center to discuss EGFR exon 20 insertion mutated non-small cell lung cancer. In our exclusive interview, Haymock discussed the incidence of EGFR exon 20 insertions in lung cancer, diagnostic challenges of identifying EGFR exon 20 insertions, and data from the International Association for the Study of Lung Cancer 2020 World Conference on Lung Cancer with mobocertinib and amivantamab in this patient subset. So let's just start by sort of setting the stage a little bit. Could you discuss the incidence of EGFR exon 20 insertions among patients with lung cancer, and how are these alterations really different from the traditional EGFR mutations?
Exon 20 insertions are about 10% of EGFR mutants overall, depending on what database you look at, it's about that number. And there are different types of exon 20 insertions and exon 20 mutations. And we think of it as sensitive insertions, and there's really one really sensitive insertion. That's one called the 763 FQEA. So this is early in the exon, around that 763 mutation. There's a few different insertions there, and those are very sensitive to first, second generation drugs, even third generation drugs, and that had previously been known. But the majority of the exon 20 insertions occur later, and we think of them as what we call either near loop or far loop mutations. And most of these, when you're looking across the exon, occur 767 or so to about 772. We consider that the near loop part, or 763 up to about 777 or so. We consider that the far loop part. And near loop and far loop refers to the EGFR structure and two different parts of the loop. It looks like the near loop mutants are a little easier to inhibit with most drugs than the far loop mutants. And I think there'll be more that comes out about this in the future. We had previously reported some of this before, and it depends to some extent on the drug. But the key point is that for the near and far loop insertions, our standard of care drugs just are not very effective. You know, if you look historically at first, second generation drugs, response rates have really been in the low single digits with those drugs, as opposed to classical mutations where the same drugs have a 60 to 75% response rate. So these are harder to inhibit mutations, and we've had to look at new drugs specifically for this subgroup.
What about some of the diagnostic challenges of identifying these rare exon 20 insertions as really a unique disease state? Could you highlight some of those challenges?
So the current assays that we use right now, most of them have been focused around our standard mutations, around the exon 19 deletions in L858R, or the standard resistance mutation like T790M, and they weren't really developed or optimized for exon 20 insertions. So if you look at some of the earlier PCR tests, while they can detect some, they don't capture all of the exon 20 insertions. Now, I think things have gotten much better as we've moved to next generation sequencing approaches, either with tumor-based profiling, so methods like Foundation One, or plasma-based profiling like Guardant. And as far as we can see, those do seem to capture the mutations effectively. So, you know, I think as we shift over to NGS-based methods to look at many genes at once, one of the additional consequences was we're also capturing more EGFR mutations than we were when we used PCR-based testing.
What are some of the current therapeutic challenges and unmet needs really of treating this specific patient population that you think need to be addressed with future research efforts?
Yeah, well, these are harder to treat in terms of finding effective drugs. And this has to do with the structure, the exon 20 insertions induce certain changes in the binding pocket where we try to fit these drugs that makes it much harder to fit a drug in there and have it tightly bind without also inhibiting the wild type EGFR. Now, of course, when you inhibit wild type EGFR, you get the toxicities from EGFR drugs, like the skin toxicities, the acne and the rash, or the GI toxicities like diarrhea, other side effects like on fingernails and so forth. So the challenge is, can you inhibit the exon 20 insertion without also inhibiting the wild type? Now, some of the newer drugs that have been tested in this space, poziotinib, mobocertinib, are tyrosine kinase inhibitors that do that better than first and second generation drugs, but still not as well as we would like in terms of they do still have skin toxicities or GI toxicities as well, but they clearly are much more active than our earlier drugs. So we've made progress, but there's still a lot more room to go. Ultimately, we would like drugs that are as selective and potent as drugs like osimertinib, where you've got an initial response rate above, 65 or 70% and a pretty tolerable toxicity profile. So we're not there yet in terms of having things as effective and well tolerated as osimertinib or other third generation TKIs for classical mutations, but hopefully we'll get there.
You mentioned mobocertinib, so could you highlight maybe some of the specific data that we've seen presented at World Lung regarding mobocertinib and sort of highlight your perspective on it, safety signals that we've seen, and just sort of your impressions for the agent overall?
First of all, it's clearly an active drug in the space. It has a clear activity that's far above what the earlier drugs, the classical first and second generation drugs, are able to do, so that's a good thing. There are toxicities that come along with it. Unlike some other drugs in the space, mobocertinib seems to be a little better in terms of the skin, but to have substantial GI toxicities. So I think toxicities that seem to be rate-limiting for most people do seem to be diarrhea and others. There are skin toxicities, but GI seems to be what's limiting for most people. The response rates that they've reported now in their full intention to treat, where they've got independent review analyses, are on the order of 25% or so in the refractory population. And, their progression-free survival is on the order of about 7 to 8 months is the ballpark. I think that's, like I said, that's clear evidence of activity. I think that's a step forward for the field. But obviously, we everybody in the field would like to get to more active drugs. From my perspective, is that better than we have in hand? Well, we don't have any approved drugs right now for exon 20 insertions. So right now, it would be standard of care chemotherapy. And to my mind, all the drugs we're seeing in the space, including mobocertinib, are clearly better than drugs like docetaxel, where historically we've got a response rate of 13%, give or take a little bit, for docetaxel monotherapy. So all the new drugs we're seeing in the space are clearly a step forward, but I think we're still in early days. I think better drugs will be coming eventually into the space, but you've got to start somewhere.
And to highlight one more drug, amivantamab, with regard to, data that we've seen presented and the safety profile of that agent, what are your impressions with amivantamab?
This is a drug that I think has, stepping back, has been the most promising so far in terms of the data we've seen to date. The response rate that they reported, and again, this was confirmed objective responses with independent review, was around 40%. And that's a substantial response rate. And the progression-free survival that they reported was closer to 11 months or so. So I think that that's really promising data. I think this has demonstrated the best data so far in this field. And it's had a very favorable tolerability profile compared to some of the other drugs. So that I think is an important step forward. I think what's exciting is that it also works by a different mechanism than the TKIs, because it's an antibody, it's a bispecific to both EGFR and MET. you know, one of the things that occurs with this is because it doesn't bind to the kinase domain itself, it's right now we are not able to predict which insertions it works well against and which ones it doesn't. It's much harder to model or understand mechanistically as compared to the tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And it's a little tougher to study preclinically. But I think very promising data so far. I think it does tell us we're going to have drugs that are active in this space that will hopefully be available to patients in the near future.
And are there any other agents maybe on the horizon in clinical development that you'd like to highlight as being particularly promising and something that we should keep our eyes on?
You know, I think we've just seen early bits of data from the Cullinan compound, the CLN-081. And I think the data set is still too small and they're still undergoing dose escalation for that drug. So I wouldn't want to go beyond saying that there's clear signs of activity and it seems to be tolerated so far. So it's one that we'll certainly keep our eyes on as well.
So is there anything else regarding EGFR mutations in general, this specific disease state, anything else that you'd like to add that we didn't touch on but you think is important to highlight?
You know, I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, for atypical mutations, exon 20 insertions are one subset of them, and they're one challenging to treat subset, but we have a lot of other atypicals as well. We have point mutations in exon 20. We have point mutations in other parts of, you know, the protein. A lot of them are in exon 18, like the 709, the 718, 719 mutations. We have 758. We've got mutations scattered throughout. You know, I'll point out Jackie Robichaux from our group presented, I think, really interesting data at World Lung that these can be grouped together, not just by exon, because exon really doesn't relate to the structure. Exon just happens to be how the introns and exons are organized in the gene. But by taking a more structure and function-based approach to organizing it, you can actually see there's one group of mutations that respond really well to second generation TKIs. And I think the point from that work was that we shouldn't be organizing mutations purely based on the exon that it's in, but really based on its the structural features and the patterns of drug sensitivity. So what I think is going to happen over the next year as we go forward is that we may move to more structure function-based classification of mutations instead of just basing it on what exon that the mutation happens to be in.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive on Air, sponsored by Takeda. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives in cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive on Air.